Morning, Ireland. Almost a quarter past eight. We're in Cork, where Fianna Fáil are gathering ahead of the return of the Dáil tomorrow. The budget, 3 weeks today, and the presidential election, 5 weeks on Friday. This is the Taoiseach's home constituency, not far from Nemo Rangers GAA Club, where his son plays in goals, and for the county football team, the last men's team to bring a senior All-Ireland back to Cork the year before Micheál Martin became Fianna Fáil leader 15 years ago. We're in Rochestown, not far from Havisham House, where Charles Dickens reputedly stayed and got the inspiration for Miss Havisham in his novel Great Expectations. Can Micheál Martin deliver on the great expectations set out by his government at the start of their five-year term this year? Taoiseach, good morning.
Good morning, Gavin.
Your first budget of this government in a few weeks, first to try and deliver on the promises of the election and the programme for government. Are you going to finally deliver on a repeated promise to give a second child benefit to struggling families?
Yeah, we're going to prioritise child poverty in this budget. And in that context, then, I think you are looking at significant moves in terms of child support payment and in terms of the working family payment, which is essentially the equivalent of
their existing payments.
But also the development of a second tier payment. What the Department of Social Protection are saying clearly to us, and I met them last week, they're not yet in a position to develop such a payment, but that they will focus, obviously, and bring to government recommendations, which will be decided by the three party leaders and the Minister of Finance and Public Expenditure, along with Social Protection, on issues to support low-income families, and particularly through the child support payment and the working family payment and other measures that will be designed to target resources at those who are facing the greatest impact in terms of an undoubted cost of living situation, particularly in terms of the cost of food and so forth. So that it will be a focus. Disability will be a focus, particularly in terms of any income supports we can enhance for families with children with disabilities and for people generally who have a disability. And then, of course, the broader issue of the carers allowance, which we've made commitments on, and the housing.
Shortly, the ESRI reported only last week that one in five children are living below the poverty line after housing costs are taken into account. And the figures which your government's, your own department's child poverty unit rely on as measurements show just under one in 10 children in consistent poverty, more than one in seven at risk of poverty, and over one in five in enhanced deprivation. How is that possible?
Well, I think given the aftermath of COVID and the war in Ukraine, inflation has spiked very, very significantly, notwithstanding very significant allocations in the last two budgets, particularly the cost of living packages, in addition to the mainstream payments increases that we delivered in the last two budgets. So we do have to deal with that, and I think we have to target resources to bring those figures down. And we acknowledge the reality of where figures are right now. It's not satisfactory, and that is why we are very clearly saying that we're going to target resources to children who are at greatest risk of poverty and who are in consistent poverty. And it's not just through the income mechanisms.
No.
It has to be across all aspects of government. So, for example, in education, we are looking at a DESH Plus model, which would mean additional resources to schools in the most disadvantaged area. In early education, we're again looking in terms of specific measures to target children in disadvantaged areas in terms of access to early education and childcare facilities. And also in terms of housing, specific mechanisms to enable families in emergency accommodation to come out more quickly out of emergency accommodation into housing.
Yeah, we heard from one case earlier on. We heard from Flavia and talking about her and her son who've been living in emergency accommodation for over 2 years. Now, there are countless studies pointing to some of the other reasons behind child poverty, like, as you mentioned, poor housing and poor access to services. Child homelessness at over 5,000 and rising, as the CEO of DePaul told us earlier on, that people are now becoming almost anaesthetised to those figures. Over 10,000 children are waiting on an assessment of needs test. Over 40,000 children waiting more than a year for community services. Given that this is the second government that your party have been in that has prioritised child poverty, why are all those figures rising and not falling?
Well, first of all, I mean, we allocate a huge funding in many years. I mean, 25% of the education budget is now towards children with special needs and so forth. I met with the city officials and Cork City Council last week. The homeless situation is more complex than presented. and the composition of homelessness today is much more complex. But the officials in the City Council said to me that up to 26% of those in emergency accommodation in Cork City refuse an offer of a house. So it's not as simple as presented. And we do need to drill down and ensure, and the Minister has brought proposals to government last week to ring fence additional housing for families, because we do need to get children out of emergency accommodation as quickly as we possibly can. But there are, given the population growth and the nature of some of those who end up in emergency accommodation, it tends to be a bit more complex than just a simple matter of housing not being available.
Your party and Fine Gael both promised in the last general election campaign to abolish the means test for the carer's allowance, currently a maximum of €260 a week. Your programme for government commits to phasing it out in the lifetime of the government. When will it be gone? Are you going to set out a timeline in this budget and show how you're going to deliver on that promise?
We will begin that process in this budget. We will do it over the lifetime of the government. And the decision in this budget will reflect that timeline and will indicate that we will have the capacity
how?
To do it over the five times. In terms of, well, obviously people know what's required over a five-year period to remove that. If we can do it quicker, we'll do it. So we will begin that process this year in terms of increasing the thresholds and the disregards.
You mean more income disregards?
Yes, yeah.
But, I mean, there are thousands of genuine full-time carers excluded from help because of that means test, even with the income disregards. Tens of thousands more still on a reduced rate, even with the income disregards. Foster carers, for example, they get €325 or €352 a week, depending on the age of the child, with no means test. The basic income for artists is €325 and not means tested. Heather Humphreys, running for president, said that to abolish the means test now, a couple of years ago, would have cost €1.2 billion. Why not just do it now?
Well, obviously, we have a whole range of pressures on us now in terms of measures that we have to take in the budget, in terms of the allocation of funding to education, health and social protection. So it's not possible to do it all in one budget, but we will do it over the next number of budgets. We've committed to doing it and we're going to do it.
But carers, Family Carers Ireland, for example, say that the income disregards, which I gather from what you're saying are going to be increased again, that they bear no resemblance to the actual disposable income of a caring household. They don't consider mortgage repayments, dependent children, college fees, fair deal contributions, medical costs and more. They don't reflect the reality faced by struggling families providing full-time care, and that the means test currently forces carers, the vast majority of which are women, to be financially reliant on their partners.
Well, first of all, I think that there's a range of supports we provide. If you take third level, for example, and we do a lot of support through the SUSE system. We've increased the thresholds fairly significantly over the last number of budgets in terms of enabling people.
But on the point raised by carers.
Yeah, I'm making the point. Yeah, but you raised the issues that the other costs that people have. The point I'm making is that in relation to those other costs, we have taken measures as well. We got rid of costs in terms of books at primary school and second level school, which was a fairly dramatic intervention by government over the last number of years. The bottom line here is we accept we've made a commitment to get rid of the means test. We're going to do it because it's going to take a number of budgets to do it.
In January, your government committed to introduce a new national housing plan to deliver 300,000 new homes by the end of the decade. When will the plan be ready?
The plan will be ready within the next month. First of all, we wanted to develop the National Development Plan because that gives you the overall financial framework for housing over the next 5 years and beyond, and that is important. And that does indicate very significant state intervention in the housing market. And parallel with that then, a number of initiatives designed to get more private sector investment into housing, which is a significant drag in terms of housing performance at the moment, particularly in terms of apartment buildings. We need more apartment buildings in addition to house building, and that will be a focus of government in the context of both the housing plan and also in the context of the budget.
But all of the available evidence and forecasts point to, at best, around 30,000 new homes this year, less than last year, and likely to miss target again next year. What's the evidence that you're going to be able to deliver 300,000 new houses in 5 years?
Not necessarily sure that it's at 30, Gavin, but let's wait and see in terms of what transpires in terms of this year in terms of housing units. The fundamental issue is we need more capacity, we need more supply. The Minister has taken a number of initiatives in terms of the rent pressure zones, in terms of apartment standards, and in terms of other initiatives, the National Planning Framework, which will allow far more rezoning of land to enable far more private sector housing to come on stream. And in addition to that, the National Development Plan outlines fairly significant state intervention. The capacity to attract private sector investment is going to be key to reaching those targets, in addition to what the state itself is investing. The state on its own cannot do all of those houses.
But the state on its own isn't building targets. All the houses now. Most of it is coming from the private sector,
Actually. Most of it's been financed from the state. Even that which the private sector is doing is very much dependent on support from state funding. And that's a problem. And that needs to be, and the Housing Action Plan will outline the degree to which that dependency has to be eased over the next decade. The state will stay involved, obviously, hugely, in terms of both the construction of social housing and in terms of the support of affordable housing, which is quite significant right now. The state's intervention will continue, but to get to the figures we wanted, to get to the 50,000 to 60,000 per annum, we quite simply need more private sector, and particularly apartment building happening. And that will be a focus
of the
Housing Action
Plan. But apartments are going to be largely for rent, aren't they?
Not necessarily.
They are currently.
If we can get at it, yes, but not necessarily into the future. And that's a big challenge for government.
Is your plan then that more supply is going to bring down the cost of houses? Like, I mean, under your government 20 years ago, you proved that over 90,000 houses could be built in a year, but they were unaffordable until the crash. Will your plan to build more houses reduce house prices this time, and how will it do that?
Well, I think again, look, the plan will moderate if we get supply through. We're not at a sufficiency for supply at the moment.
What do you mean moderate? What do you mean by moderate?
Well, like at the moment, house prices, not over the last number of years, has increased continually. Notwithstanding the fact that we've moved from about 20,000 houses being built in 2019 to about 30,000+. We exceeded our targets in housing for all, by the way. But that took a big shift from the 20,000 houses.
It's not nearly enough to meet.
Hold on a second. I know, from 20,000 a year to 30,000 a year. We need to get to 50,000. We're focused on solutions. Others are just knocking every proposal that comes
forward. That reduce prices? Because
I'm not going to make... with respect, I mean, prices...
Do you want them to reduce
We do, of
prices?
Course we do, yes. We want to reduce... At the moment, they are increasing because we don't have a sufficiency of supply. If we get a sufficiency of supply, we can get better access to the market for young people. And we're supporting young people at the moment.
But they could have to buy a scheme. Even with access, they won't be able to afford the houses.
Well, we're supporting, and significant numbers of first-time mortgages have been drawn down over the last 3 years. But the prices are too high. The prices at the moment, in our view, are too high. And that's a huge issue for us and for people out there, particularly young people who are in the market trying to buy a house. It's excessive at the moment, and we need to reduce that. The only logical economic way to do that is to get more supply into the market. I don't see any other way of getting prices down.
You talked about incentivising private investment. Are you going to offer more tax breaks to developers to build more houses?
We don't discuss that in the advance of a budget in terms of potential impact.
I don't mean in this budget, but is that part of your plan? Is that part of the National Housing Plan that you're going to have coming forward?
We will do everything we possibly can to facilitate private sector.
And will that include tax breaks to developers?
So we're going to look, I'm not getting into any specifics in terms of the forthcoming budget, in terms of tax issues. Right now.
And for people who don't have access to the market, who are going to be depending on social housing, when are you going to reach your social housing targets?
Well, I think without question, in the last 4 years, we've dramatically increased the number of social houses built in this country compared to what was going on the previous 10 or 15
years.
It's
way below your own targets. You would accept that.
Well, not way below. I mean, 12,000 were delivered in 2023, about 10,000 last year. 8,500 that, yes, new build. We want to get to 10,000 minimum new build, if not more, but some were leased and some were acquired from the private market. So there's been a consistency around the 10 to 12,000 mark in social housing at the moment. We want to continue that over the next decade to build up a very strong social housing stock for people who are at income levels that don't enable them to have any chance at all of buying their own.
The presidency, Jim Gavin, did you go to him or did he come to you?
I think people came to us and suggested him, and we then met him and engaged with him.
So you went to him, yes?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there was a conversation. I mean, how this happened, a lot of people get mentioned to us. I'd say up to 20 names were mentioned in terms of people who would have been potential presidential candidates. Some came looking. Jim gave it great thought, as is his wont. I mean, he didn't rush into this. He is a person of considerable substance, experience.
Did you go to anyone else?
He was during the middle of the summer, he was the person that we engaged in a very serious and substantive way. And while we were doing that, we didn't engage with others.
You kept it very quiet. I mean, how many people in the party were involved in getting him to the nomination stage? Less than 10?
So when you say the nominee, I mean, the bottom line was we made it very clear we were going to clarify everything at the end of August. I mean, people knew we were sounding out and everything.
Most people in the party didn't know what you were doing.
Yeah, well, look, with respect...
How many did?
I watched all of August. We were not going to be part of that sort of silly season speculative. Every time you talk to someone, you're on the front page of the following morning. That's not the way you prepare for a presidential election. You have to be strategic about it. But in fairness to Jim Gavin, he's a person given he's peacekeeping background, military background, and so on. He really deliberated on this, thought about it, and said he was up for it and wanted to run. And as you know, others in
were you surprised?
Forward. When I met him and had a very good meeting with him, I knew he was going to give a consideration, and I think he was ensuring. He was testing or talking to me and talking it through and so on like that. You know, I immediately, when I heard of and people close to him came to us and suggested that, without talking to him, I think initially, that he would be a potentially strong candidate. My own sense was he had the breadth and the depth to be a very serious candidate. I'm somewhat struck that people seem to think nowadays that you have to have party political experience to be a candidate for the presidency. That's a new development, really, in a sense, because that would restrict the presidency to just one cohort and category of people. I actually think that he is... very significant experience that covers all the various capacities that are required to be president. I think above all, he will be an active president. People I speak to, after having spoken to him, I spoke to quite a number of people who worked with him, who knew him, and who spoke very, very highly of his character and his integrity and his capacity to get things done, and that he is a true professional.
Fianna Fáil councillors are telling our reporters they're very annoyed at not having a say. They agree with Leo Varadkar in thinking that he was a Fine Gaeler. His nomination was against the biggest backbench revolt of your leadership. A weekend poll in the Business Post showed 29% of Fianna Fáil voters will vote for Heather. Are you sure Fianna Fáil grassroots will campaign or even vote for your candidate?
Well, previous presidential campaigns should tell you, Gavin, forget about the polls until about the last week, OK? Just forget about them. They're not going to really be a barometer or a metric for what's going to happen. I think the last 10 days will tell a lot. Secondly, the Ardesh decides the rules. The rules were the same today in terms of councillors' voting rights and so on as they were at the very beginning of the presidency. This wasn't me, Aunt Martin, or anybody else. That's just the way it has. And I think in some respects, because it reflects the fact that Eamon de Valera, when he created the office in the 1937 constitution, actually said very explicitly that he wanted it to be above party politics.
Yes, but could you not find anybody within Fianna Fáil?
No, sorry, I just made a point. He wanted
could
to be above
find
party
a woman
politics and so forth. It's about a person that emerges that you feel can command more than just party support, but that has a broader reach out into the community. Jim Gavin has that, and he has very significant capacities. And there was no revolt, by the way. I mean, an election within a parliamentary party is quite a legitimate exercise in a democracy.
I was there
when Mary McAleese, and the late Albert Reynolds, and late Mihal O'Kennedy had a contest within the party. We united very quickly afterwards, and Mary McAleese got elected as president. There was a tremendous atmosphere in the parliamentary party yesterday. I think Billy Kelleher, excellent parliamentarian, energised the party in terms of his candidacy with Jim Gavin. And I think Jim Gavin made the point that he was very struck by Billy's character in the immediate aftermath of the election in declaring his support for Jim and urging the party to get behind Jim.
One man who won't be president, won't even be a contender now, is Conor McGregor. Earlier this year, you were Donald Trump's guest in the White House 2 days before St. Patrick's Day, and on our national holiday itself. How did you feel when you saw that Conor McGregor was being feted in the Oval Office?
Well, I'm not impressed by that at one level, but at another level, American politics is what it is, I think. There's a strong, seems to me, MMA component part of the of an electoral base there. It may have had something more to do with that. I think the views of Conor McGregor are ones I clearly do not share.
Was it humiliating?
No, not at all. Not at all. I don't see it that way. The things like that don't impact me in that way, you know. I mean, I had a job to do when I visited the president. We had a very courteous, very, very hospitable engagement with the president, and we had a good meeting. And as far as I'm concerned, I focus on the objectives I have for the country, the national interest. We have a very strong relationship with the United States, economically, politically, family to family. It underpins very significant jobs in this country. And that's important for people in terms of bread and butter on the table. And so the bilateral relationship, the relationship with President Trump is a very important one.
Before I let you go, 15 years leading Fianna Fáil now. You told the Sunday Times at the weekend you plan to lead Fianna Fáil in into the next general election, that'll be 20 years, and more if you stay on after the election. You'll be into your 70s then. One of your predecessors, when we asked him about how long he planned to stay in the job, mused that some Chinese leaders rule into their 80s. Are you heading for thinking like Haughey now?
I remember after that he didn't do too well in terms of that commentary. I get sort of tired of these questions because every general election...
Could go on forever though, couldn't you?
No, it was only 8 months. Well, how long? 9 months since the general election. We won a good win. But the issue has to be on the issues that face the people. I'm focused on the issues we discussed earlier, the budget, housing, and so on like that. I'm energetic. I engage. I enjoy politics. But it's not just about enjoying politics. It's about getting things done. I'm still anxious angry at the lack of progress on issues around disability and the issues around housing. And so there's issues to be pursued, not just pursued, but we need to achieve targets in relation to these issues. And fundamentally on disability, I did a lot of work in earlier days in education and disability and in health. It does pain me to some degree, notwithstanding population increase and all of that, that we're still not where we should be. We are going to make moves in this government to change and have a step change in terms of the quality of life of people with disability in this country. And that's something I want to achieve along with the housing issue.
Taoiseach Micheál Martin, thank you. 7:55, you're listening to Morning Ireland live in Cork. Brian Jennings is in Dublin with the latest news.